This podcast is intended for the blind and the print impaired. Hello, my name is John Lucy, and welcome to a new edition of SAVE, S-A-V-E, Salute a Veteran Every Day. This program on the Triangle Radio Reading Service is in honor of the many men and women who have served in the U.S. military and have helped keep America free. We're happy you joined us. On this edition of the program, we'll talk about some more about the impact our servicemen and women have made and continue to have on North Carolina. We'll also highlight some important dates during the month relating to America's military past. We'll offer our own salute to a veteran. Today, our studio guest is Jim Cronin, who served as a Marine helicopter pilot in the Vietnam War. Following our discussion with Jim, we'll give you a preview of some of the most important military days in history upcoming for the month of May. But first, let's take a look at the huge impact the military and our veterans have on North Carolina. As many of you know, the military in North Carolina really is big. The state boasts the largest military installation in the country, Fort Bragg. That helps North Carolina to rank third overall in terms of military presence in the United States, trailing only California and Texas. Overall, the military supports roughly 10% of our state's economy. This amounts to some $30 billion in state personal income and $48 billion in gross state product. The gross state product is the total in terms of all goods and services produced here. And now some interesting information about North Carolina veterans. About 750,000 vets live here. Broken down by age group, those in the 60 to 69 age category total some 187,000. Second in size are those vets in North Carolina who are in the 50 to 59 age group, with about 145,000. Former military in ages 70 through 79 account for about 121,000 people. And the smallest categories are those in the 20 and below and those 21 and to 29. These two smallest age groups of vets are expected to grow this year, with returning war troops mustering out. As you may expect, Charlotte ranks first with the sheer number of vets living in that vicinity, with 146,000 people, which is one-fifth of our statewide total. The Triangle area is second, and the Piedmont Triad is third. All in all, a huge number of vets have chosen to live in the Tar Heel State. Active duty, reserves, National Guard, and former service members and their operations here have a huge impact as well. Now let's look at some important military dates occurring during April. First, Monday, April 6th. That date marks the date in 1917 when the United States entered World War I. The assassination of Archduke Ferdinand of Austria by a Serbian nationalist in Bosnia in late June 1914 actually sparked the beginning of what was referred to then as the Big War and the War to End All Wars. The United States joined the Allies in 1917 against Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire. The Allies, of course, were Great Britain, France, Russia, Italy, and Japan. The 4 years of World War I saw unprecedented levels of carnage and destruction, thanks to grueling trench warfare. Also, the introduction of modern weaponry, such as machine guns, tanks, and chemical weapons. More than 9 million soldiers were killed, and 21 million more were wounded in WW1. American casualties were nearly 117,000. In all, military and civilian, more than 18 million people lost their lives in World War I. Our next important military date is Sunday, April 12th, some 34 years ago. It was on that date in 1982 when the first U.S. space shuttle was launched. Columbia was the name of that operational space shuttle vehicle, the first reusable spacecraft. Its test flight came on April 12, 1982. Columbia became a workhorse for the shuttle fleet, flying 27 successful missions over 22 years. Sadly, as you may remember, the Columbia attempted reentry into the Earth's atmosphere on Saturday, February 1st, 2003. But the ship exploded and broke apart over Texas, killing the seven astronauts. Columbia's first flight was commanded by astronaut John Young, a veteran of four previous space flights, including a walk on the moon in 1972. Navy test pilot Bob Crippen piloted this first Columbia flight, which ushered in this new era in America's space program. Then on Saturday, April 25th, 1898, that marks the beginning of the Spanish-American War. That war was rooted in Cuba's struggle for independence against Spain, which began in February 1895. America was dragged into the war after the USS battleship Maine was sunk in Havana's harbor on February 15, 1898, 3 years later. On April 24, 1898, Spain declared war on the United States. The U.S. declared war on Spain on the 25th, retroactive, that is, to April 21st. So the ensuing war was pathetically one-sided, according to historians, since Spain did not ready its army or navy for a distant war with the much-too-powerful United States. The shooting in the Spanish-American War ceased with Spain's surrender on July 17, 1898. But before it did, U.S. Navy Secretary Teddy Roosevelt became a folk hero with his participation in the so-called Rough Riders Cavalry in Cuba. In the Treaty of Paris, which was signed on December 10, 1898, Spain renounced all claims to Cuba. It also ceded the islands of Guam and Puerto Rico to the U.S., and it also transferred ownership over the Philippines to America for some $20 million. Our last highlighted date for April is April 30th. That marks the 40th anniversary of the conclusion of the war in Vietnam. This date is also the subject of today's in-studio interview with a veteran who was there. We'll speak with our special guest in just a moment, but first, a bit of background on the Vietnam War. Of course, many of us in the audience know full well that the Vietnam War was long and costly as an armed conflict. It was on April 30th, 1975, that the war officially ended for the U.S. some 40 years ago. That war had its beginnings back in 1954, way before the U.S. became involved. More than 3 million people, including 58,000 Americans, died in that conflict. More than half the casualties were Vietnamese civilians. At the war's peak in 1969, America had more than a half million military personnel involved in that war. Growing opposition to the war here at home led to bitter divisions among Americans. President Nixon ordered the withdrawal of U.S. forces in 1973. 2 years later, communist forces seized control of Saigon, ending the war. Vietnam, the North and the South, was unified as the Socialist Republic of Vietnam the following year. Today we salute another veteran who was there in time of war. This time it was the Vietnam War. His name is Jim Cronin. Jim, it's good to have you with us today, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, John. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and maybe we jump into then how you came to get to Vietnam.
Okay. I was born in Columbus, Ohio. I'm among the first of the baby boomers generation. My father was a Navy veteran, and my mother was a housewife. I went to Ohio State University for a while and then partied a little too much and studied a little too little, so I was invited not to return one semester. So I went to part-time to a business school, and then I decided that I wanted to look into the military.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to enlist, went to the Army thing because I understood they had a helicopter pilot program, and I sat there for an hour and nobody talked to me, so I got up and walked down the hall to the Marine Corps recruiter. They promised me a rifle and a hard time, which they definitely did. I went in enlisted, went from the Columbus to San Diego Marine Corps Recruit Depot, mm-hmm. which was a little unusual because most east of the Mississippi go to Parris Island, but they had a shortage of space, and my group of guys was sent out there.
What year was this?
This was 1967.
67, okay.
So I actually enlisted in May and ended up going there on July 2nd.
And this was really the build-up period during...
Vietnam had actually... The build-up was actually 66. 67, it started to grow, and of course, 68, it was full-blown. So anyway, I finished boot camp, and while I was in infantry training... I was asked if I'd like to apply for officer candidate school, and I said yes. So I was put on hold for a while and visited Los Angeles and found out one of my mother's friend's son was the best friend of the manager of the Playboy Club, so I got to spend Christmas with Playboy bunnies. It was not hard to handle.
Not a bad
one. Of course, in those days, you didn't have cell phones, so I have no proof. But in any event, I went to OCS in February of 1968. Finished up with OCS, which, if you're not familiar with OCS, mm-hmm. is a pretty heavy training program, almost similar to boot camp in the beginning, except a lot of it is involved with intelligence testing, leadership skills, that type of thing, where boot camp is mostly discipline and marching and shooting and things like that. Then I applied while I was there to flight school, and I was accepted as a flight trainee, and unusually at that time, they were sending pilots, they were sending students to the Air Force and the Army to train because Pensacola, which most Marine Corps aviators train at, was too full.
And you didn't have a choice, you didn't have a desire to be either a fixed wing or a helicopter at that point?
I decided I prefer to be a helicopter pilot.
Okay.
I could have applied to things, but it turned out it was for the best in the long run because a lot of the Air Force pilots were unable to transition to Marine Corps aviation, so they didn't get to fly fighters, which they'd hoped to do. The reason is the Air Force has a different way to land their aircraft than the Marine Corps and the Navy do. The Navy and the Marine Corps have to land on carriers. The Air Force lands on nice big runways. And a lot of them couldn't transition, so they ended up flying transports instead of fighters,
okay.
which was disappointing to a lot of them. But anyway, went to the Army, trained with the Army. That was the fall of 68. Finished up in the summer of 69, at late spring of 69, actually, and then came back here to North Carolina and was sent to New River Air Station down near Jacksonville, and spent several months there. And then in 1970, very early 1970, actually the very beginning of January, I went overseas. And I first went to Okinawa, and which is everybody went to Okinawa and then they were sent off. And I thought, sure, I would go to Vietnam, but instead I actually stayed on Okinawa. I was assigned to a squadron that floated around the Pacific on an aircraft carrier, which was kind of fun. We got to go to Hong Kong and Korea. And I actually flew from Okinawa to Japan over open water, which was kind of fun, 800 miles. Which helicopters normally don't do, but we had two internal tanks and were able to do it. And then we actually sat off the coast of Vietnam during the Cambodian crisis, which was in spring of 1970, all of us sweating big bullets because we had only enough armored seats for about half the helicopters and only enough machine guns for about six helicopters. So if we'd had to go ashore, we would have been woefully underprepared. So anyway, so that I came back, and after I got back from that trip to Japan, about 4 days after I got back, I got orders to Vietnam. So I got to be in Vietnam in May of 1970, was assigned to a squadron HMM 262. HMN stands for Helicopter Medium, Marine Medium, just the same as the large things were HMH, Helicopter Marine Heavy. And at that time, I was convinced to fly in Vietnam.
Tell me about when you got there. What you were on the periphery. You weren't in the country yet, but of course you had heard of the things that were going on there. What was your feeling when you landed there? Maybe landing is the wrong term, because were you flying? You were flying in.
Yeah.
What was your thoughts about what was before you?
Well, mostly it was excitement. Different people went in there with different thoughts. To give you an example, I actually flew down with a guy who was talking the whole time about being afraid of dying. That wasn't exactly exciting. There was a major sitting. We were second lieutenants, well, first lieutenants, actually. And there was a major sitting in front of us in the plane, and he turned around and told the guy to shut up because he was depressing. And so when I got there, I was actually excited. As most Marines, 99% of Marines will tell you, they want to see action. I mean, they didn't join the Marine Corps to sit in the back lines not doing anything.
And you did as well.
And I did as well. Mm-hmm. I was no different than any of the others. The first thing I remember about Vietnam was getting off the airplane and the heat, the smell. There is nothing like a third world country to wake you up to how fortunate we are in the United States. I discovered several things. The insects are bigger. The rats are bigger. All of the different things are bigger in a third world country than they are in the U.S. So that was my first view of Vietnam. So actually it was somewhat taken aback, but actually I was looking forward to it.
So after you got there, you got settled, and what was your first duties? Did you start out flying just as soon as you got there?
Actually, not right away. There's about a four-day session before you actually get to fly. Mm-hmm. They give you a little orientation. They talk about what you're going to be doing and how you're going to do it. You get to meet up people in the squadron, get to know the crews and the crew chiefs. And then you actually go out as co-pilot with a more experienced aviator. As a matter of fact, I probably did that for the first two and a half months I was there. And then you can get the designation as a helicopter aircraft commander, which means you sit in the pilot seat and drive the whole thing. And if you're there long enough and get enough experience, you become a flight leader, which means you fly the lead for two helicopters.
Well, what would a typical, during this transition period or a ramping up period, what would be a typical run that you would be involved in?
Okay, initially we would go out on resupply missions,
okay,
which means we would load up with sea rats and ammunition and things like that, and we'd fly out to different bases where the Marines were located, generally mostly artillery bases. And we drop supplies off for them, pick up anything they had to go back, like mail or people who were getting sent home, and fly them back. And we might hit, on a typical mission, we'd be gone maybe 3 hours, and we'd hit four or five different locations during that period of time. Then we'd stop somewhere and refuel, and then go back, load up more supplies, and go out. We generally flew anywhere from 4 to 8 hours a day, every day. 7 days a week.
On these earlier trips, did you encounter any fire from down below?
Very little the first few days. Mm-hmm. The main reason was they wanted you to get practice as where you were going. And generally speaking, the lead pilot would let you fly the whole mission or most of it. So you really never got in a situation that was too serious. It wasn't really until probably 2 or 3 weeks in that I actually got shot at.
Well, I must ask that question then. What did it feel like when you first encountered being shot at and you're up in the sky and the only place is down?
That's true. The only place is down. Actually, the adrenaline starts to pump, obviously. Mm-hmm. And generally, the pilots don't know unless they happen to be shooting right in the front of the helicopter.
Because of the noise all
because
the time.
You don't hear the noise.
Yes.
Obviously, they're shooting from the ground, and you're in the air with a very noisy helicopter with helmets on and everything
mm-hmm.
else. But what will happen is you'll hear the crew chief say, "Sir, we're taking fire from the right." And you'll hear the 50-caliber machine gun start to shoot, mm-hmm. and then you realize you're being shot at. I only one time heard an actual round hit the aircraft, and that was when it bounced off my armored seat. Yeah,
right next
to my head.
Yeah,
yes.
I guess I could ask you what you thought then, but I guess
that's why they pay you the extra $100 a month.
Well, did you you were encountering this ground fire? Did you do evasive actions, or you just stay on your path?
Depending on where you were, mm-hmm. Marine Corps approaches landing zones different than the Army does. The Army generally comes in a straight line and lands down. The Marine Corps actually spirals in. And the thought always was that it was much harder to hit something moving in a three-dimensional space rather than a single-dimensional nice. Space. And so if you were coming in to a particular LZ with an important mission, you just kept going. I mean, there was no stopping. If you were in a position where you could move out of the way and try another approach, then that occasionally happened. Not frequently. Generally, the Viet Cong were pretty smart. I mean, they didn't generally shoot at you on the way down. They shot at you on the way out. The reason is you're going slow. You're not getting out as fast. Lots of times they don't even know you're approaching till you get there. And so it's too late for them to set up. So the worst time actually was usually coming out of the LZ, unless the LZ was already under fire. If the landing zone was already under fire, then you could expect to do it. I won't say we avoided landing zones that were under fire, because sometimes you couldn't. If you had to get a medevac or you had to do something like that, then you had to go in. But normally, if the LZ was under fire, we would call in support, other armed helicopters to shoot, to try to suppress the fire, and then we go into the LZ.
We had a discussion earlier, and you'd mentioned that you flew a number of medevac flights that got the adrenaline flowing.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about ones that you might remember.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me tell you that everybody wanted to fly medevac. A variety of reasons. First of all, it was a very important mission. It was the one that got your adrenaline flying more than anything else. But generally the ones that you did, a lot of them were routine. You would just fly out, pick up somebody, and bring them back. And some of them were pretty hairy, because you'd be going into an LZ knowing you were trying to save a life. And if it was dark, which it often was at night, and you haven't seen dark until you've been in a third world country, it gets very dark. There are no lights. And so you would go into an LZ, and it might be taking fire, but you still land and pick up somebody. We generally had a corpsman or two on board. The corpsman is the Navy medics that stay with the Marine Corps. And you would go in. They would do first aid on the helicopter as you flew them back to what was known as Charlie Med, mm-hmm. which was the med center. It's like MASH,
yes,
except a little more sophisticated in that day and age. And you would land there and you'd listen. And I'll never forget sitting there one day, having picked up a couple of guys that had actually stepped on landmines. And they were hauling them on gurneys past the helicopter. And one of the guys looked at me and gave me a thumbs up. That's something that's vividly in my mind.
And you remember all of these
and
years.
And you remember, at that point, you realize that what you're doing is really important.
Talk to me a little bit about, a little bit later, you had mentioned in our earlier conversation that you ran into some fire and you weren't so lucky at that one occasion.
Yeah, we were actually on what was supposed to be a routine resupply mission. And we had gone in to an artillery base near an area that was called the Arizona. And it was called the Arizona, it was known as a free fire zone. That means there were no friendly troops in there, and if anybody saw anybody moving in there, they were supposed to shoot at them. And we picked up a bunch of people. We had a full load of people on the helicopter, and we were taking off, and we took fire from the nearby village. And we just think it was probably a Viet Cong that dug his AK-47 out of the bushes and just shot off a bunch of rounds and got lucky. Blew a fuel line, as near as we can tell, so we lost an engine, and we went down and we crashed.
You didn't spiral down.
No, no. We probably would have landed safely, except there was a young woman with a child right under us when the engine quit. And so my co-pilot at that time and I both pulled up on the controls to lift the thing up about 20 feet. We were only 50 or 60 feet off the ground tops. And so when we landed on the slide of a slope, and the helicopter rolled over and burned up. But everybody got out safely.
So, as I understand,
some injuries and bruises and stuff like that and cuts, but no.
Well, congratulations! Serious. I understand that you were the recipient of the Purple Heart. For
yes,
that.
I was.
And on behalf of everyone, we thank you.
You're very welcome.
We thank you for all that you've done. What if you had to do it over again? Was there anything you would change?
No. I was very fortunate to have what I have to consider to be a good tour. I came back with all my limbs intact and nothing serious wrong with me. I got to know the excitement of being shot at and missed, for most part. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the experience of fighting with Marines, there's nothing like it. I mean, they're just fantastic people. And they're people I've known my whole life now. And I still keep in touch with a lot of them. We have reunions every couple of years. I don't think there's anything I would do over again.
We were talking earlier about... And I grew up, or I was in business during that period. And I remember reporting, as I did, that it wasn't the most pleasant of times for the troops coming back.
True.
Can you talk a little bit about what you felt from this lack of respect and the other things that were happening around the time you got back?
Well, the interesting, in those times, Marines usually traveled on orders with their uniforms on. And so you got a certain amount of abuse. Now, I was never spit on. I was given some dirty looks and some side remarks that, you know, that were not particularly unslanderous. But I never really suffered any real negative things because at home everybody knew me, so it was just Jim coming home. So I really didn't get a whole lot of the treatment that a lot of the troops did coming back.
But you must have had some thoughts about what was occurring. I know I certainly did. I was in the military about that time frame, and it was just... I can't describe the anger that I had.
A lot of resentment,
thoughtlessness.
Yeah, a lot of resentment, a lot of hard feelings. The interesting thing is, I was an art major early in my college career, so a lot of my friends were from the left. So that was a really interesting experience to hook up with them again and find out that but they were all very civil to me. There was no antagonism. And looking back over the years, I was very fortunate in that period of time that I was really never exposed to a lot of the hate and vitriol that was common in that time.
One other thing I'd like to ask, when you were in country and fighting was around you, what kind of information were you getting through Armed Forces radio and television and otherwise that helped you understand what was happening? Sometimes you get close to a situation, you don't know exactly what's occurring.
Well, most of the time you don't care. I mean, your main concern is what's happening right around you, because that's your friends, your combat, that situation. Being an officer, I was more informed than a lot of the enlisted people were, because I was near the source of a lot of the information. I knew the planning for operations. I knew where we were going, what we were going to do. But generally speaking, we had radios in the helicopter. We used to listen to Armed Forces radio while we're flying along. And the main thing you listened to was rock and roll. I mean, you really didn't want to hear the news. Who cares, you know?
Adrian Kronauer from the Good Morning Vietnam fame.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for being here, for what you do for TRRS. You're on our board of directors, and we thank you for that. And I'm going to say thank you, because I really do appreciate, because a lot of my friends saw action, and we're so indebted to help us come through that period. So thanks for being here.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
We're so glad you chose to spend some time with us listening to our Salute a Veterans Every Day podcast. We urge you to do just that and extend a thank you and a salute to any and all veterans you come into contact with. And remember, salute a veteran every day. They certainly deserve it. This program is for the blind and visually impaired. I'm your host, John Lucy, thanking you for being with us. Be sure to tune in to the next edition of our program. The edition to which you are listening will continue to be available as a podcast until the next one, which will be available on Wednesday, May 13th. So long for now.